Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Moors and Moors Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay, and this evening we will be dealing with, does the mafia exist today in America? Now, the way I see it is, if you have a crime syndication and you know they are criminals, why are they not in the news every day? Why is there not television cameras assigned to these people, places of business? Because if they're operating in crime, it's supposed to be illegal. I mean, you're out here on the streets, you're stopping people for traffic tickets, you are actually exercising freedom of rights to travel. You're dragging them in the courtroom, you're putting them in jail, locking them all up. But these particular criminals are not only major criminals, but they're also committing acts of murder. But yet, we don't hear anything about it on a daily basis, unless something happens and one of them get killed, and they may make a little headline and last for a day or so. But after that, it's business as usual. Anyway, we're going to deal with, are there crime families operating in the U.S. today? Who really killed Jimmy Hoffa? What happened between the Kennedys and the mafia? Did the FBI solve the mystery? Why are these families allowed to continue operations? Where did these people come from? These are some of the questions that we want to deal with here this evening. And we're going to start up in the recent times. We want to deal with this Hoffa situation because that will give us a great deal of information on the current situation inside the United States. And the reason that more should know about this because it is occurring inside of Mexico. And we need to know what's on there, okay, and what's going on. So I took the time out. We've examined the mortgage thing and all of this stuff. First of all, let me say I'm offering my free articles. As usual, the 14th Amendment exposes the commerce game and how to play, Secrets of America, and the United States bankruptcy and the Moors. Now, to get that, send me an email to tahaka53@hotmail.com. I'll put that information in the chat room. You can call me before 7 p.m. at area code 904-303-9061. Before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll get you in there. Okay? Be ready.
Greetings. I'd like to invite you out to the Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th, 2013, located in Jacksonville, Florida. 3 days of executing and planning of executive plans for 25-year agenda, operating as an economic unit. The presenters will be Shem L. of the Tamarind 2 Project, Dr. Ali Muhammad and Minister Inki of the Black Genetic Tour, Sundiana Amma L., Professor Isef Deanham L., Tahaka Amana L., Abundance Child, Fatima, the Alchemist Shabazz, Messiah L, and more. Topics will be the execution of urban geoponics, creating independent distribution systems, creating independent economic systems, genetics, private security force, the wholesale and manufacturing of natural products, Morristown, creating one in every state, Morris Eastside Farms, putting one in every state. You do not want to miss this summit. It is very enlightening, empowering, and most of all, it's applicable. Everything that we talk about, we do. Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th. Log on to www.summitofthemoors.com. You can register for free. The summit is always free. You can also get your hotel room, which will be on the river at the Wyndham Hotel. That's www.summitofthemoors.com. The summits are always free. See you at the summit.
One more time, Mo. Don't forget, for those of you who are trying to do your estate, now, inside the archives, you have your estate manual, you have your estate letter, and you have all the other supporting documents. And for those of you who want to get out there and place that thing in the hands of your employee to stop it from taking taxes out your check, go right to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Once you get there, look around. If you click on the letters under the picture, a little drop-down menu will come back and give you a little additional information on that. But before you do anything, call me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, for those of you who want to set up your will, all that information is in there as well, right there in the Talkers Master Library. Don't forget, www.newfreehelpgroup.com, okay? All right. All right, Mo, we back. Let me add, for those of you who are on your social sites, if you're on Facebook, LinkedIn, MySpace, what have you, go ahead and send me a friend request. That way it can be granted. You have access to the wall, the articles and stuff we posted there for your education. Now, I've been banned by Facebook again for 30 more days for attempting to be friends with my people. And so you send your friend request, and I'll grant that. That'll give you access to my wall. Let's get down into this thing. Let's get some background on this thing and find out what's going on before we get down into the meat and potatoes of this situation. Okay?
Upstate New York, November 1957. In the sleepy town of Appalachian, an extraordinary meeting was taking place. Gathered in the garden of one of the town's wealthiest residents, a gang of sharp-dressed businessmen feasted on several hundred pounds of steak. This unusual group attracted attention, and the local cops looked on astonished. What they didn't know was that they were witnessing a summit meeting of the entire leadership of the American Mafia. In fact, until that moment, many denied the Mafia even existed. Sure, there was crime, but organized crime, a criminal gang with secret initiation rites and codes enforced by sentence of death, seemed like something out of the movies. Across the Atlantic in Sicily, things were much the same. Here, in the birthplace of the Mafia, its influence reached into every corner of life. Yet its very existence was often denied. Secrecy and internal discipline gave the Mafia its power. And this power was about to go global. 1957 marked the moment the American and Sicilian Mafias became international, forming a billion-dollar crime corporation. It was a turning point in another way, too. It signaled the start of a war against organized crime that would last almost half a century, a war that forced both the U.S. and Italy finally to confront the terrifying criminal conspiracy in their midst.
Thank you.
United States in the mid-1950s. The good times were here. The country had emerged from depression and World War with a booming economy. For many ordinary men and women, the American dream had become reality. But something else was booming too. The mafia. For those growing up in a family associated with the mob, it was as if the outside world barely existed, apart from being a source of easy money. The mafia is organized in groups called families. The head of the family is known as the boss, or the godfather. And the longest serving New York boss of all time was Joe Bonanno, known as Joe Bananas. He ran the Bonanno family from the early 1930s until the mid-1960s. Bonanno's power was founded on the influence he wielded over his community in New York. His son Bill saw firsthand how his father operated and himself became a leading gangster with the Bonanno family.
My father would, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, would go into this hall and sit in an office in the back, and various people from the neighborhood would come in and ask favors. Somebody had a sick child and she couldn't pay the doctor, and my father would arrange for that. Somebody else had a husband who was cheating on her, and she wanted to know what to do. He would take care of that. That happened twice a week. So when that happens, you begin to form the ideas that when you have a problem, you know where to go.
This is home movie footage, shot in Brooklyn in 1957. It looks like any ordinary American family, enjoying the new prosperity. But looks can be deceiving. Dominic Montilio was born into a mob family in New York. Some of his relatives were senior mobsters in the Gambino crime family, another of America's leading mafia families. Montilio was aware from an early age how his relatives were unlike others in the neighborhood.
I grew up in a very traditional mob family, and it was a very different kind of life than my other friends had. You know, I noticed that from the beginning, because there was times when, well, the FBI would break down the door, because, I mean, we lived in the same house with my uncle, and he was very connected.
Montilio's uncle was an up-and-coming gangster called Nino Gaggi. One day when he was 11, Dominic ran home, bursting to tell his uncle Nino that he had been elected class president at school.
I came home all excited because I had the button, you know, said president on it. And he said, oh, great. He says, what does the class president do? So I said, you know, teacher goes out of the room and you watch the class. If anybody does anything wrong, you write their name on the board. And he looked at me and he says, you're telling me you're a rat. You're a stool pigeon. So I said, I mean, 10 years old, 11 years old, what are you going to say? And he said, well, tomorrow you got to go back and give that button back to the teacher and tell her you can't be the class president.
Bill Bonanno and Dominic Montilio both grew up in a world closed to the outside. The American mafia called itself Cosa Nostra, our thing. But this was a world imported to America from several thousand miles away. This is where the mafia came from. Sicily, the largest island in the Mediterranean, with a population of 5 million, less than 2 miles from the Italian mainland. Like Montilio, Leo Luca Orlando was born in 1947, in Palermo, Sicily's biggest city. Unlike Montilio, he would grow up to fight the mafia, not join it.
Sicily is a land of contradictions. Palermo is the capital of Sicily, is the capital of the mafia too. It's the capital of the history, is the capital of the shame of this land.
In the Sicilian dialect, mafioso once meant bold or beautiful. From the 1860s, it became the name associated with the island's criminal element, who were often organized into families of men related by blood or marriage. But their existence was steeped in secrecy. Even discussing the Mafia was taboo, as Orlando found one day at school.
When I was 15 years old, I organized with other students a seminar about the Mafia and against the Mafia. The director, the Jesuit director of the school, called my parents and said, "It is a scandal. Why Lucchetto is speaking about the Mafia? We have nothing to do with the Mafia, therefore we are not to speak about the Mafia." Gray area. Not seeing, not speaking, not hearing. It was Sicily when I was a young student.
Joe Bonanno grew up in this world. He was a native Sicilian, born here in the pretty seaside town of Castellammare del Golfo in 1905. He only moved to America in the 1920s.
Sicily has a long history of mistrust of authority. There's an old saying back there that to know a man, you have to know his father, and his father before him, and his father before him. And once that happens, there is very little room for betrayal.
Much of the power of the Mafia derived from its ruthless discipline. Chief among these values was omerta, the vow of silence. In Sicily, all mafiosi had to take a sacred blood oath that they would never betray the organization to the authorities, and that they would always carry out the orders of their mob bosses. The novice was sworn in through a quasi-religious ceremony and became a so-called man of honor. The American Mafia followed exactly the same traditional initiation ceremony.
You're brought into a room and you're given the image of a saint. Prick your finger, enough to draw a drop or two of blood, put it on the image of the saint, put the saint in your hand, and they light it. And you take an oath, and it simply says that you hope to burn as this saint is burning if you betray your brothers.
To break this oath would mean death.
Our culture taught us to act like men. And acting like men meant keeping your mouth shut.
But for Bonanno and his fellow gangsters, omerta was more than just a vow of silence.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, that was just the underbelly trying to get the foundation down before we come on up to what's going on today and lead on up to what happened inside the United States with these families, how they got into the Teamsters Union, what happened with that, the president's involvement, politicians' involvements, and all this stuff. We need to know that because that is occurring inside the United States. Most of us, we've began to study about the Illuminati and all of this stuff here, but we must never forget that this thing here is taking place as well. Also, don't forget that on August the 16th through the 18th, we'll be hosting the Moorish Summit right here in Jacksonville, Florida. So make your way down here so that you can be a part of this thing. Let's go in here and let's take a look at this thing, okay? Let's go.
So what really became of Jimmy Hoffa? It's an enduring mystery. When he vanished in July 1975, he was one of the best-known people, most famous or infamous, if you prefer, people in the entire country. Was he buried under Giant Stadium? Was he stuck into a wood chipper and chopped up? Was he scattered over a number of different states? Was he buried in any number of fields that have been examined and investigated by the FBI and police over the last almost a half a century? Did he meet his end at the hands of a friend? I think after you hear this interview with former prosecutor Charles Brandt, the case will be closed for you. We'll be coming back with the story of I Heard You Paint Houses. That's the title of Charles Brandt's book, and this fascinating tale of the hitman who did the deed. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Charles Brandt is a former teacher, welfare investigator, homicide investigator, prosecutor, and chief deputy attorney general for the state of Delaware. Then he went into private practice. He's named as one of the best lawyers in America. But I think despite his lengthy and impressive resume, He might be best known as the guy who solved the mystery of Jimmy Hoffa, because once you hear this interview, I think you'll agree that the mystery has been solved. Charles Brandt, great to have you on the program.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you. Nice to hear your voice again.
Yours as well. And I heard somebody last week when this story came out about the FBI digging up a field in suburban Detroit, looking once again for the remains of Jimmy Hoffa, and then, of course, folding their tent, not finding anything, based on a tip from this aging mob guy. I thought about you immediately, and I thought to myself, I knew they weren't going to find anything because I knew your story. But I heard a political commentator on the air say, who cares about Jimmy Hoffa? And I'm sure there are people who are saying, yeah, I don't care about Jimmy Hoffa. It has no effect on my life. So maybe we start there, Charlie. Why should we care? Well, what is it about that story that makes it such an interesting mystery all these years later for a lot of people? And why is it still important?
Well, that's a good question. I think obviously younger people can't even imagine that it is important they never heard of Jimmy Hoffa, let's put it that way, except as the butt of a joke. And so I think as a human being, he's long ago lost to us. As a figure that's been missing, and with all kinds of theories about where he is, that gets old. I mean, you start digging up for him, and you dig, and you dig, and you dig, and at some point, even people who care about him say, come on, enough already. I think there is a kind of tiredness to that story. I'm sorry to have to say that, because I wrote a book that deals in large part with what happened to Jimmy Hoffa, but it's definitely a story that, as time goes on, people kind of tire of the digs, I think.
Well, if you like stories about the mob, if you like mob history, if you like stories about how Las Vegas grew, how the mob took over basically organized labor for a period of time, I think it is still compelling. And of course, just the fact that it's never been solved is enough to grab me, but it might not grab everybody. However, Hoffa was a major, major figure in American politics and the organized labor movement. Why don't you begin by telling our listeners how he ranked, why he was so important?
Oh, sure. I think that part of it is absolutely fascinating, and I think people are fascinated by it. The book came out in 2004, and it's never gone out of print. It's constantly selling, and they're going to be making a movie out of it. But I thought I was responding to the question about it as
sure.
Another dig for Hoffa.
Right.
Enough already. Nobody expects you to find Hoffa anymore after all these years, is I guess what the way I should have said it. But today, when we think of a labor leader, we immediately think of Jimmy Hoffa. He was by far the most powerful labor leader America's ever had. Whatever the working man or woman of America needed a sense that there was somebody advocating for them, well, that person was Jimmy Hoffa. He was afraid of no one, and he made the American worker feel, I'm on your side. The politicians might not be, and they're my enemy. The corporate America might not be on your side. They're my enemy. I'm Jimmy Hoffa. I'm on your side. And he did an awful lot for the working people. The problem was that at the same time, he made alliances to further his goals, and those alliances were with some of the most dangerous people in the country, the organized crime.
And did he need to make that deal to cement his own power to do the things he accomplished for workers?
He certainly felt that he did. He felt that the corporate America hired thugs and goons to break strikes back in the old labor wars, when people would get their heads busted by billy clubs. And that was around the time I was born. That was still going on in 1942, you know. And he felt that he needed to fight fire with fire, and so he formed alliances with the mafia bosses. And what he offered them was a lot of power and a lot of opportunities to make illegal do-re-mi. You know, the title of the book, I Heard You Paint Houses, those are the first words that Jimmy Hoffa ever uttered to Frank the Irishman Sheeran. And to paint a house is to kill somebody. The paint is the blood that spatters on the walls and the floors. And Hoffa, it was 1957. He had just officially taken over as president of the Teamsters. And he had enemies within his own Teamsters organization that he needed to get rid of. So he felt. And he contacted his ally, the mafia boss Russell Bufalino, looking for some muscle. And Russell lent him the big Irishman, 6'4", 220 pounds, and by far the toughest man I ever met. Frank the Irishman Sheeran was not just physically tough, he was mentally tough, and he had been schooled in the art of killing in World War II. He was in 411 combat days. He was in three amphibious invasions. Well, 411 combat days is really an outrage. At 200 combat days, they offer you an opportunity to be discharged. The average was 80. He was in the entire war from beginning to end, and he was in General Patton's, quote, killer division, unquote, the Thunderbird Division, 45th Infantry Division. And Patton had counseled that group to be the – I want the Nazis, the Germans, to be more afraid of you than any other division I have. You're not to take prisoners. You're to be the most ferocious fighting force I have. And they were. The initial atrocities that came out of World War II, the initial arrests, they were all – out of the 45th Infantry Division, and their defense when they would be court-martialed right away in the invasion of Sicily, a captain and a sergeant were court-martialed. They had mowed down a few dozen prisoners each, and they used that defense that Patton had just finished telling us before we came into Sicily from North Africa. He just got finished telling us not to take prisoners. So that was the schooling that Frank had. He was extremely tough. He was a battle-hardened, seasoned veteran of some of the worst fighting the world has ever known.
And then prior to the military, he grew up in a really tough area of Philadelphia, a mostly Italian neighborhood. You say in the book that he basically had to get in a fight every single day.
Yes, he did. George, you're something. yep, he had to fight his way to and from school, Catholic school. You know, his father was a man who had studied for the priesthood. He spent 5 years in a seminary, and his mother went to Mass every single morning. His father's two sisters, Frank's two aunts, were teaching nuns at the Catholic schools that Frank went to. He didn't finish school in those days. Not that many people did. You know, my parents, neither of my parents set foot in high school. But, you know, the depression and things being what they were in that part of the world, Frank never really had a chance at an education, but he was a very bright man and very, very pleasant guy. Very, he had an almost Huckleberry Finn lifestyle, although he had to do a lot of fighting. He really didn't do anything wrong until after he got out of the Army.
Well, Huck Finn is an apt example in another way, in that Huck Finn had pap, and Frank Sheeran had a father who liked to put on the gloves and box him around right up until he was a teenager, just beat the hell out of him.
If you could see my smile right now, my goodness, George, absolutely. His father was an amateur boxer, and his father would toss him the gloves when Frank did something wrong, and Frank was not allowed to hit back. He was allowed to defend himself, and the father would just pepper him with left jabs, left hooks, rights, and he toughened Frank up. Finally, at one point in his life story, Frank ended up hitting the principal of the school, the Catholic school that he was in, breaking the principal's jaw. Frank was 16. His father worked in the Catholic school system, and when he got home, his father tossed the gloves at him, said, "You broke his, you broke the principal's jaw." And Frank looked at his father and said to him, "You better get yourself another punching bag." He said, "I would never hit you. You're my father. But we're not doing this anymore." And he threw the gloves at his father. And that was the last time his father ever laid a hand on him.
So he fought his father. He fought to break a grown man's jaw.
I mean, that's gotta get someone's attention.
He fought his father. He fought going to and from school with this these Italian tough guys in this neighborhood. But it benefited him in other ways because he got to know Italians. He got to learn the language a little bit. And that came in handy later when he met the other major character in this story, Russell Bufalino. Tell us a bit about Bufalino, because when you think of organized crime figures, you think of Al Capone or you think of Gotti. A lot of people don't know his name, but he was a really a major guy, maybe the guy.
He really was the guy. The ruling commission that no longer exists, thanks to the Mafia Commission case in 1986, but the ruling commission, the five families of New York City, Buffalo and Chicago, the heads of those families, made decisions for the rest of the nationwide organized crime families. But they never did anything of any importance without consulting Russell Bufalino, whose acumen, whose intelligence, whose strategizing, whose wisdom was legendary among all of these other bosses in the country. And so before they did anything of any consequence, they consulted Russell, and he either gave his yay or his nay on it, or took it over himself and planned it and took care of it. He was located in the northeastern Pennsylvania in the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area. You could go to his drapery store and buy draperies, or you could, as the CIA did, go to him with a plan to kill Fidel Castro. And that's a well-known, admitted by the CIA during the Church Committee hearings of 1975, that the CIA engaged Russell Bufalino and the head of the Chicago Mafia at the time, Sam Giancana, with a plan to kill Castro.
I know that story well because the meetings were held, planning meetings, right here in Las Vegas. Robert Mayhew, an ex-CIA guy who worked for Howard Hughes, helped set it up. Johnny Roselli was sort of the go-between. And we'll come back to that because I want to get into whether or not Frank Sheeran had something to do with or knowledge of the JFK assassination. But for now, let's stick with Bufalino. Something happened in 1957. It sort of ripped the lid off the whole story about the mafia. I mean, people knew there were mobsters like Al Capone, but they didn't really realize that there was a ruling commission that these families of different cities worked together until the events of 1957. Tell us that.
Well, in a town in upstate New York called Apalachin, it looks like you want to pronounce it Appalachian, but it's pronounced Apalachin up there, lived a mafia boss named Joe Barbera. And there were some things that were happening in the nationwide mafia that required attention. A renegade wannabe boss named Vito Genovese killed Albert Anastasia killed, a rival boss, and he had the boss of his family shot at, Frank Costello. Costello survived the shooting and then retired. Costello was the boss of the Democrat Party of the city of New York. He hand-selected who would be on a grand jury, for example. That's why one of the main reasons the mafia was able to flourish. They controlled everything back in those days. And Genovese needed to be talked to. There needed to be, and he needed to explain himself And he needed, it was bigger than the commission. It required the entire nationwide organization to meet. They also needed to discuss some drug deals that later became known as the Pizza Connection case that
the Banano
Connection. Crime family was structuring, where drugs were brought into Canada, to Montreal, and then from Montreal disseminated to the rest of the country. This was heroin. And in those days, 1957, we didn't have the drug problems that we had now, but there still was a drug culture. In any event, the meeting was noticed by a state trooper. He saw these black Cadillacs, 1957 Cadillacs, arriving in this small town in upstate New York. And they were arriving at Joe Barber's estate. And so the FBI, not the FBI, I'm sorry, the state of New York, the state troopers, set up a roadblock, surrounded the house, set up a roadblock. It's depicted comically in the movie Analyze This with
Billy Crystal
playing a psychiatrist to the mafia boss played by Robert De Niro. And literally, even though it's done comically, it's true. The mafia bosses ran away, trying to run through the woods to escape this crackdown that was put on by the state troopers. And 60-some-odd mafia bosses from all over the country were arrested. And for the first time, we got a glimpse in America. Oh, my God, there really is an organized crime, a nationwide organized crime. It isn't simply that there's Al Capone in Chicago or, Tony Zarilli in Detroit. These people are all connected. They're all working hand in glove.
And what it also came out is that Bufalino had a certain stature in that group. I think you describe him in the book, and I don't know if it's your words or Frank Sheeran's, but he was most like Don Corleone, that portrayal in The Godfather.
Oh, I've got news for you that's not in the book that I learned in one of my talks. You're going to like this. He definitely was the person that Marlon Brando modeled his portrayal of the Godfather, Don Corleone, after. I got to know, as you know, George, after writing I Heard You Paint Houses, I had the privilege of working on a book with the real Donnie Brasco, Joe Pistone. Many of your viewers may be familiar with, listeners rather, may be familiar with the book.
I tell you what, Charlie, I'm sorry, but that music tells me we need to take a break. When we come back, though, I'll let you finish that story, because that's when we get into sort of the meat of the whole tale of how Jimmy Hoffa met his end, the role that Russell Bufalino played in it, and how it went down, what became of his body. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Outlaw Men is what we're talking about tonight with my guest, Charles Brandt, author of the book, I Heard You Paint Houses. Now, if you heard the explanation for that title, it's mob lingo, sort of code words for I Heard You Kill People. The discussion was directed to the guy who pulled the trigger. If you always wanted to know who killed Jimmy Hoffa, we're about to hear the name of the trigger man. Also, the name of the man who ordered the hit, gave the okay, and what became of Jimmy Hoffa's body. The definitive story of what became of Jimmy Hoffa, what happened to the remains, and we're jumping into the heart of the story with my guest Charles Brandt right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Charles Brandt, author of the book, I Heard You Paint Houses, the definitive book about the murder of Jimmy Hoffa, and one of the very best mob books about the mafia that I've ever read, and I've read them all. Check it out if you get a chance. Charles, before the break, you were telling us about why you think Russell Bufalino was, in fact, the model for the Don Corleone character in the movie The Godfather.
Yes, I was explaining that I had the privilege of writing a book with the real Donnie Brasco, who was played by Johnny Depp in the movie, along with Al Pacino as the mafia character, Lefty Guns Ruggiero. we wrote a sequel to the original book. It was called Donnie Brasco 2 Unfinished Business, where we got to talk about things that Joe couldn't put in the first book because he was still testifying about his 6 years working as an undercover in the Bonanno crime family. And Joe and I became fast friends. We're really good buddies. And he introduced me to the singer Al Martino, who played the Johnny Fontaine character in The Godfather. And Al has a fascinating story. He unfortunately died in October 2009 at the age of 82 of a heart attack. But before he died, he and his wife Judy and I became very good friends, and he confided some things in me. And he told me how when it came time to cast the role of Johnny Fontaine, he had it wrapped up. Francis Ford Coppola decided he didn't want him. He wanted a real actor in that role. And so Al went to his godfather, Russell Bufalino. Oh, yeah. And Russell said to him, and Al felt not only was he entitled to the role, but he had expended $50,000 in promotional money to try to help get the picture made. And he wanted his $50,000 back, or he wanted the role. And Bufalino said to him, you've got the role, and you're going to get your $50,000 back besides. So he was called into the head of Paramount and told that Francis is not happy with this. You've got the role, but he's going to ostracize you on the set. And these were all young actors, Al Pacino, Diane Keaton, Robert Duvall. The only one who had any kind of history in the movies at that time was James Caan. The rest of them were young people looking for their break. And Al Martino said to me, you know, I didn't mind that that Francis, every chance he got, he shot me in a way that you couldn't see my face. You may remember in the movie how you see his white sport coat. He's being shot from behind a lot. He's walking under some branches, and you don't see his face. You see the character he's walking with. And so Al got a lot of disrespect from Francis Ford Coppola, and the other actors would eat by themselves. We eat together, but they would ostracize Al. And Al said he didn't mind because Marlon Brando made up for it. Marlon taught him how to act and took him to and from the set in his private jet and really took an interest in him. So I was telling that story in 2011 at the Sun Valley Writers Conference. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and introduced herself. And she said her name was Wanda Ruddy. And I knew immediately who she was. Her husband, Albert Ruddy, was the producer of The Godfather. And she said to me that Russell had final script approval for the movie The Godfather. That's how powerful he was.
Oh, my gosh. So the irony of the Al Martino character, the Johnny Fontaine character, who was also trying to get a part in real life. That's just amazing.
Oh, it's an amazing story, yeah. So that, but it's hard to conceive how powerful a labor leader was. That would be Hoffa. It's hard to conceive how powerful and entrenched the mafia was in our lives. They had a gluttonous slice of the American pie.
All right,
they really controlled so much of what we did in those days. Well, they helped build your town, Las Vegas.
Well, that's for sure. I should mention The strip was built basically with Teamster money from the Teamsters pension fund, and millions of dollars that built most of the hotels on the strip until the corporations came in. And all that money came with strings attached. The mob got to put their own people into all these casinos. Tens of millions of dollars were skimmed.
Yeah,
but that's an entire different show. Let's draw some lines.
A finder's fee. Whenever they negotiate a loan for you, you wanted to build a hotel. We'll give you a loan from the Central States Pension Fund of the Teamsters, but we get 10% of that money. So if we get you $20 million, we get $2 million.
And this was approved by Jimmy Hoffa. Basically,
he had
to sign off on it.
Yeah.
So let's draw the links between Bufalino and Hoffa and Sheeran, how they all fit together. Because Sheeran was good friends, became good friends with both of those men. Let's start with how he met Buffalino, how they became friends.
Sure. After the war, Sheeran did what tried to have a kind of normal life. He got married in his parish there in the Catholic Church. He had three daughters, and he was driving a truck for Food Fair, a big grocery store chain back east. And his truck had broken down in Endicott, New York, at a truck stop. He couldn't get it started. And this little Italian man came over to him and asked if he could help. And Sheeran spoke Italian, not only from his neighborhood as a kid, but also in the Italian campaign. I mean, he was there from the invasion of Sicily right through as our soldiers went right up the boot of Italy. And they hit it off. There was something about Sheeran, this man that came over to help him. Russell Buffalino was not just a powerful mafia boss, he was also a certified mechanic, and he knew what to do to get the truck started. And he took one look at this 6'4" Irishman who spoke Italian and instantly took a liking to him. I think he recognized a certain characteristic of toughness that Sheeran had. The way Sheeran expressed it to me, you know, he said, in those days after the war, we didn't have war syndrome. I'd wake up in the middle of the night in a full sweat, wondering what I was doing in a bed. He said, I never got more than 4 hours sleep a night after the war. And that was kind of written all over him when you met with him. Even when I was dealing with him and when he was 80, he had that same toughness about him. That same kind of film noir, they call it, those movies of that era, of the post-war era, those black and white crime dramas where people are so ruggedly tough. And Buffalino literally recruited him, suggested that they meet for dinner in Philadelphia, which they did. There was a mafia boss in Philly, Angelo Bruno. Buffalino was the boss of the state of Pennsylvania, except for the city of Philadelphia. He was the boss of upstate New York, chunks of New Jersey, and chunks of New York City, and as far as his territory is concerned, in addition to his many other boss-type situations. In any event, Russell introduced Frank to Angelo Bruno and Angelo Bruno's people, and they all found ways to help Frank make extra money, pick something up, deliver something, whatever. And he was a truck driver, so it kind of fit. He might be going somewhere, and he'd take care of a matter for them. And finally, it reached a point where he had to do something really wrong. He was hired by a guy named Whispers to torch a laundromat, a big laundry that did restaurants, you know, that provided the linen for restaurants. And he was hired by Whispers to do it. He was seen staking out the laundry, and he was immediately called into Angelo Bruno's restaurant, the Villa de Roma, which still exists on 9th Street in the Italian section of South Philly. And sitting there was Russell Buffalino, his mentor. And they wanted to know what he was doing. A big guy like him, seen clearly casing the laundry facility. And he explained that Whispers had hired him to do it, to torch the laundry. And they said to him, don't you ask? Don't you know what you're doing? Who do you think owns that laundry? And it turned out that the Jewish mafia owned that laundry. The Jewish mob owned the laundry, and it was under Angelo's domain. Angelo had a piece of it, Angelo Bruno. And he was told that he needed to get rid of Whispers, or he would go. And the first killing that he did was around 1955. He killed this Whispers, and then he was in. He was in from that point on.
course, he could never be a...
And now you're part of the thing, is the way they express it.
He could never be a made man because he was not Italian, though.
That's correct. He could never be a made man. And Russell would reach up and tweak his cheek and say, oh, if you had only been born Italian, the things I could do for you, my Irishman. And that was his nickname, Frank the Irishman Sheeran. Russell had given him that nickname.
He eventually became sort of higher in the hierarchy than a made man, or at least, you know, he was directly under the boss, right?
That's exactly right. Kind of like the Robert Duvall character in The Godfather. He was so close to Russell that nobody could ever touch him. He was way higher than your typical made man.
So he becomes
finally, you know, you work your way up there. As I said, he was very intelligent, very charming. My wife said, you know, I had to pinch myself after spending time with him to remember that he was a killer. Very, very charming, very witty guy.
How many guys do you figure he killed? I mean, we're jumping ahead, but how many do you admit to?
That he killed 25 to 30. He really had no patience for sitting there with me to count them, you know. But he would give me an illustration on occasion. And as I don't think I've said this yet to your audience, but he was extremely close to Jimmy Hoffa. Russell had put him in with Hoffa, and he moved up the ranks until the point where he had his own Teamsters local 326 in Wilmington, Delaware, as president of it. And he was destined to greatness in the Teamsters. He was extremely close to Hoffa. And when the Mafia felt it was time to get rid of Hoffa, they selected Frank because Hoffa was wary at that point. He knew that he had made some enemies, and he knew he had to be careful. And they knew that Frank Sheeran could get close enough to Hoffa to kill him.
We'll come back to that part of it, but tell me a little bit more about how he became close to Hoffa and how much Hoffa trusted him, what he did for Hoffa in return.
Well, the first thing he did after that job interview, it actually occurred at the Villa de Roma in Philly. I take that back. It was the Friendly Tavern. It was one of the two, the other place they hung out. Sheeran was sitting with Russell when a phone call came in for Russell. The phone was brought over to Russell's table. Russell handed the phone to Frank Sheeran and said, say hello to Jimmy Hoffa. And Hoffa said, I heard you paint houses. Frank said, I do my own carpentry work, too, which means I get rid of the bodies. And the next day, Frank was in Detroit, assigned to two henchmen of Hoffa's, and was put to work. The way they handled the killings was that Sheeran, the target would be pointed out. Sheeran would shoot him right on the street. There would immediately be a getaway car. He would hand the gun to someone. He would get in the getaway car. They had crash cars, other cars that were parked right in that spot. In case a police car came along, a crash car would come out and end up crashing into the police car and blocking its way. And Sheeran was then sent to Chicago. And he said, Chicago was, if your dog was with you, your dog went too. Chicago was wide open in terms of killings in those days. And they were all Teamster-related beefs. The idea that Hoffa had was that solidarity was needed within the labor movement. And the so-called rebels were really doing the bidding of management. And the corporations, the people that were fomenting a rebellion within the union. And he would put these fires out for Hoffa. They became such good friends as a result of this that Sheeran was literally the only man who could get close enough to Hoffa to kill him. And it haunted Sheeran the rest of his life. It's how I was able to make my inroads in speaking to Sheeran. I had him for close to 5 years. I taught interrogation to cops. I taught cross-examination to other lawyers, and I didn't just have Frank Sheeran on the witness stand for an afternoon. I had him for close to 5 years, traveled with him, went to the mafia circles with him, and had some unique experiences along the way. But boy, did I get an education. And the book, you know, there are like four chapters that deal with the Hoffa murder. The book has so much in it. My effort was to get inside the mind of this murderer, why he now felt remorse as he was about to meet his maker, and why he wanted to get so many things off his chest. I tell you something, George, the most fascinating and gratifying piece of this for me has been the Crazy Joey Gallo hit that took place at Umberto's Clam House in Manhattan's Little Italy.
Well, I wanted to get into that. I'm not sure. We're going to go to a break in about a minute and a half, so I don't think we have time to tell that, but we'll do that on the other side. But I had told the audience in the beginning, in the introduction, that the Sheeran stuff by itself is fascinating. But, you know, regardless of Hoffa, he did a lot of other things, and his life experiences give us so much insight into how the mafia operated. Regardless of Hoffa, he was an interesting and important character.
You bet, George. I appreciate you saying that, and I'm very proud of that, that the book is a biography of a very interesting man in a very interesting era, and much of it's in his own words.
So he became very close to Hoffa because of jobs he'd done for Hoffa. He became very close to Bufalino because of jobs he did for Bufalino, the kinds of things that you only trust to people who are really close to you. Was he working for other people as well, other high-ranking folks? No?
No, he just Hoffa and Russell. Initially, he did some things for Angelo, but they were minor little things. One of his lines to me was, people think that Ange lent me to Russell, but it was the other way around. Russell lent me to Angelo. So he did get lent to Angelo a little bit, but he didn't do any killings for Angelo.
We're talking with Charles Brandt, author of an excellent book called I Heard You Paint Houses, The Story of Frank the Irishman Sheeran, How Jimmy Hoffa Met His End. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear the story about Crazy Joe Gallo. It's been sort of public knowledge that other people were responsible for his death. We're about to hear the true story of who was responsible, how Frank Sheeran fits into that story. And then into the nuts and bolts about the murder of Jimmy Hoffa, how he was set up, how he was killed, and most importantly, what became of the body. It's a story you likely have not heard about before. As I mentioned in the beginning of this program, we posted sort of an excerpt from one of the stories that I was able to put together a couple of years ago based on an interview with Charles Brandt. Check that out if you want to put some of the names and faces together. And we'll be right back and pick up the story of the murder of Jimmy Hoffa right after this on Coast to Coast. Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. We're talking with Charles Brandt, the author of the definitive book about the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. The title is I Heard You Paint Houses. We've been sort of setting the table here so far, now have met all the major characters, the hitman himself, Frank the Irishman Sheeran, the mob boss who ordered the hit, Russell Bufalino, and, of course, Hoffa, the target, the most powerful labor leader the country has ever had. When we come back, one more tale about a hit by Sheeran involving Crazy Joe Gallo, and then into the how and why of Hoffa's murder and what became of the body. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Brandt, let's talk about the case of Crazy Joe Gallo. I know it's not central to the Hoffa story, but I consider it important because it sort of establishes Frank Sheeran's credentials and his credibility in that, you know, history had one view of who killed Joe Gallo, and you've proven something entirely different.
Correct. I was at a retirement party for some Teamsters with Frank. And I had my tape recorder out, as I often did. You never know when you're going to catch some odd comment. And we were sitting together, and I asked him, why is it that Russell thought so highly of you? And he said, well, if I tell you that, then I'll have to tell you something that I did for him. And I said, well, don't be shy. Come on. You can brag a little bit with me. What did you do for him? And he said, did you ever hear of Joey Gallo? I said, sure, crazy Joey Gallo. Frank said, a fresh kid. At that moment, one of the Teamsters at the place took a candid photograph of Frank and me and a table of beer bottles in the path on the way to us. And I still have that photo. I take it out and look at it to remind me of the moment he confessed to killing Gallo. And when he confessed to it, I said, now, wait a minute. There have been the prevailing story was a guy named Sonny Pinto and these two Italian brothers, Benny and Cisco from Little Italy, barged into Umberto's clam house in the wee small hours of the morning. It was around 5 in the morning. It was the only place open in town. And opened fire on Gallo. They wounded Gallo's bodyguard, and as Gallo tried to get away, they finished him off. And he said, well, if they want to take credit for it, that's all right with me. And it was clear to me that he was telling me the truth. There were two movies at the time about Joe Gallo. One had Peter Boyle, who was a feature on Everybody Loves Raymond as the father character, but a younger Peter Boyle as Joey Gallo. The other had Jerry Orbach from Law and Order as Joey Gallo. There were several books, and they all had that Sonny Pinto story, and the idea was that Sonny Pinto had fled to California, and nobody had ever heard from him again. And Benny and Cisco, nobody knew much more about them. Those were nicknames. And so the case was never solved. And that story was out there that three guys had done it. And Sheeran was telling me, no, three guys had nothing to do with anything. It was me. Well, the book, I decided, you know, I'm letting it all hang out. I have 5 years' worth of interviews of Frank Sheeran on tape. And if he tells me that he did something and I get a chance to question and re-question him on it, use my skills of cross-examination, I know the truth when I hear it. And that's going in my book. And in it went. And despite the prevailing stories, and I mentioned the prevailing stories, well, it turns out that not only was it a lone gunman, Detective Joe Coffey, who's the author of the Coffey Files, his cases that he handled in New York. He was a homicide detective for the NYPD. The Gallo case was his case. He had let the story out there that three guys had done the hit as a kind of integrity test in case he got any phony hot tips. But he knew all along it was a lone gunman and a big guy. And when I told him what I had, I managed to get a hold of him. I just loaded with law enforcement connections, as you might imagine. And he said, well, that's it. You know, you've solved it. No sooner does that happen than a reporter for the senior correspondent for Fox News Channel, a guy named Eric Shawn, learned that an editor at the New York Times was there at the time Gallo was shot, and she was an eyewitness. So Eric called her up, directed her attention to a photo of Sheeran that was on the Internet, and she said, oh, my God, this picture gives me chills. She positively identified Frank Sheeran as the lone gunman who came into Umberto's clam house and killed crazy Joey Gallo, shot his bodyguard in the butt to disable him. So it was a kind of integrity test, my putting it in the book. You know, if Frank Sheeran has integrity, here it is. If you can show me that he didn't do it, if someone comes forward and says, wait a minute, I was an eyewitness and there were three shooters, well, then my book's full of baloney. And I don't know what I'm doing, my many years, my decades as an interrogator and cross-examiner. I don't know what I'm talking about. If he turns out to be wrong here, you have every reason not to believe anything else he told me. And he turned out to be more than right. He passed his integrity test.
That was a big deal, that hit, because Crazy Joe Gallo essentially went to war with the other families in New York and was on a rampage. He had to go. So killing him was a major assignment.
Major deal. He was trying to start the sixth New York family. And it was a big deal, and he knew. I mean, he knew he was a marked man. So it wasn't like somebody like Sheeran could just take him by surprise. You know, it was quite a hit.
So Sheeran passed that test. Let's get the story of how it is that you came to earn his trust, because you had been a cop, you're a homicide investigator, you were a prosecutor. That doesn't sound like somebody that the Irishman would open up to. How is it that you came to gain his confidence?
Well, I was in private practice as a medical malpractice lawyer. I had done some criminal defense work after I left my job as chief deputy attorney general for the state of Delaware, where I was a homicide prosecutor. And I did some criminal defense work. And Sheeran, you know, I was a big deal. I don't think I toot my horn, but I was a big deal in the state of Delaware. And Sheeran was in the state of Delaware. His local was in Wilmington, Delaware. And the FBI essentially solved the Hoffa case within, let's say, 2 or 3 months. They put together a list of the suspects, one of whom is still alive, living in Las Vegas, Tommy Andretta, and we'll get to him later. Hopefully, if we don't run out of time. But in any event, Bob Garrity was the case agent in charge of the investigation. He attended a book signing of mine in 2005 when the paperback came out, and Bob and I became fast friends. Bob had written a memo called the Hoffex Memo, and in that memo he listed 9 suspects. 8 of those 9 literally were the entire group of conspirators that were involved in the killing of Jimmy Hoffa in that hit. The 9th was the brother of one of the other 8, and so it was presumed if his brother Sal Bergoglio was involved, then Gabe had to be involved, but Gabe wasn't involved. And so the FBI had solved it, and they put pressure on all of those people that were involved in the conspiracy. The FBI just could not and had no way of knowing what happened, how it went down, who did what, how was Hoffa even killed. They had no way of knowing that. They just knew from their informants, from their underworld informants, they were getting sources who were telling them these are the 8 involved. Russell Bufalino and Frank Sheeran were at the top of the list of the 8 involved. And Tony Provenzano, Tony Giacalone, Tommy Andretta, Steve Andretta, Sal Bergoglio, and Chucky O'Brien, who had an Irish name but was Italian. That was the 8. There's the 8 of them. And the FBI went after all of them and got them for other crimes, the way they got Al Capone for tax evasion. And they ended up getting Frank Sheeran for labor racketeering and giving him a total of 32 years in jail. Someone else would have gotten 3 or 4 years for that. But they were determined to put enough pressure on these people, hoping one of them would crack. And they're barking up the wrong tree with Frank Sheeran. The FBI would visit Sheeran once a month and tell him in prison he's got the keys to the jail in his pocket. All he needs to do is cooperate with them. And he said you had to go and meet with them when they summoned you into prison, but you were allowed to just turn around and walk back out. And so he just turned around and walked back out. And as he was aging, his arthritis, he had severe spinal stenosis where you've got an arthritic spine. And he was having trouble walking. He was his right leg was starting to wither. And I was doing medical malpractice work, and I got a call from the Philly mob. They wanted to see if I could get him out of jail on a medical release, early parole. And he would get his surgery and his aftercare. And, you know, at that age then, he was in his early 70s, you know, not be a 71 years old, actually, you know, not be a problem for anyone. So I represented him and got him out of jail. And in representing him, I had to get tough with him. I had a younger partner at the time, Bart Dalton, and Bart went down to the prison to get Sheeran to sign papers that we needed in order to file for early parole. And he returned telling me that Sheeran wanted to sue the warden, wanted to sue the two trial judges, the prosecutors, the FBI, the police officers, and he was just ranting. He was ranting. So I went down to the prison. It was about 50 miles south of Wilmington in the town of Smyrna, Delaware, and I went down to the prison to talk to him and to explain to him that the procedure that we were going to use of early parole on medical grounds would be a one-sided procedure. The prosecutor's office would never know we were there. It's done at the jail with people sitting as a small parole board who are civilians that the warden appoints. And the warden doesn't want to have to take care of an elderly man with severe spinal stenosis surgery. They're happy to get rid of you, to get you out of the jail. But the second you start suing people, the FBI is going to get wind of it, and they'll make sure you never get out. And while I'm talking to him, he's just glaring at me. And when I'm done, he goes on this monologue, this monotonous monologue about how he wants me to sue everybody and his brother. And I let him roll. When he was done, I said, Frank, I wish you could hear yourself talk. Then you'd know you weren't making any sense at all. We're filing for medical parole as we've been paid to do. If you decide you want to sue all these people with this screwball idea you have, you do that after we're done, if you can find a lawyer stupid enough to do it for you. Guard, I'm leaving this paper. If it's not signed next week, then I'll know you don't want us to represent you. But if you want us to represent you, my partner's coming down here in a week to pick it up. Guard, we're out of here. So my partner went down the next week. He comes back, and he says, oh, God, Charlie, it was unbelievable. I'm worried about you. All he would talk about is you. He never gets talked to like that. Nobody's ever gotten away with talking to him like that. Don't forget, he had Goronsky killed for coming late to a meeting and spilling wine on him. This thug, Fred Goronsky, he had him whacked. And we could never prove it, you know. And I said, yeah, and he was involved in the Hoffa suspect, too, because by then it was pretty well known. He'd been profiled in the New York Times and Newsweek, and there'd been six books written about him that he was involved somehow in the Hoffa disappearance. And I said, well, this one counts, I guess, then, and we better get him out. Well, of course we got him out. That wasn't a problem. But my stock went way up in his eyes, because the mafia was used to telling lawyers what to do. They weren't used to being told what needs to be done by the expert, by the lawyer. And he took us to dinner, I mean the lunch rather, at Vincenti's restaurant in Wilmington, heard on FBI wiretaps as the wine shop. And I had written a novel called The Right to Remain Silent. Detective Lou Razzi was an ace master interrogator, and it was based on homicides I had solved, true stories, homicides I had solved through interrogation. And but it's fiction. But I could point to the cases and say that's, you know, State v. Fulman, or that's State v. Clark, you know. Anyway, Sheeran took me aside after the lunch and said that he had read my book in prison and that he was tired of being written about in all the books on Jimmy. He wanted to tell his side of it, and he wanted me to tell it. And this may sound strange to your audience, but I knew immediately that this man wanted to get something off his chest. The way I had spoken to him in prison, he knew he wasn't talking to some patsy. He read my book. It's a pro-Law and Order book. And it actually dramatizes how interrogations should be done. Now, if you don't want to risk confessing, you don't want you don't want to talk to me. And this was 1991. And we ended up scheduling a meeting at his apartment in Springfield, Pennsylvania, which, by the way, is the same town that Al Martino was from. And Al Martino was a bricklayer in Springfield and a World War II veteran wounded in Iwo Jima. Anyway, so I go up there to meet with Frank Sheeran, and he answers the door. He was using a cane then, and I see this chubby man behind him wearing a suit, and the last thing you want is another person. You know, you want to be there alone with your subject. And he says, "This is my lawyer, Charlie Brandt. This is my other lawyer, Jimmy Lynch the Catholic." That was his name. And he puts his hand out, says, "How you, Charlie? How you doing?" So I figured, well, the worst that'll happen is I'll get material from these two characters that I can use in one of my next Lou Razzie book, you know. So I'm in the bathroom and the phone rings, and I come out, and Sheeran is hunched over the phone, being very respectful to whoever's on the other end of that phone, saying, yes. It turns out that the guy on the other end of the phone was the underboss of the Buffalino family, a guy named Billy D'Elia, Billy D'Elia. And Sheeran says to Jimmy Lynch, the Catholic, that thing, we got to go do it now. Now? You don't do it when, and just Sheeran stammered, so I'm imitating him. You don't do it when you want to. You do it when they tell you, and they don't give you no notice either. Ah, well, what are we going to do with Charlie? I said, guys, I brought work from the office. I'll sit right here at the dining room table, and I'll work until you guys get back. And Sheeran said, no, he's coming with us. Oh, God. I'm off for a ride somewhere. It has something to do with the mafia, I'm sure, you know. So Jimmy Lynch is driving. Frank's in the front seat. I'm in the rear seat. Turns out it's the seat that Jimmy Hoffa was in when he took his last ride in Detroit. The rear passenger side. And I'm sitting literally thinking to myself, you know, if somebody's going to, this is a setup, and somebody's going to hit Frank Sheeran because he's now out of jail and maybe knows too much, and they're afraid he's talking to me, we're all going to go. I mean, they don't just kill Sheeran, you know. I had no idea where we were going. We
Charlie
ended up
Brandt,
at a restaurant.
Hold on a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you. The music is telling us we need to go to a break. When we come back, we'll pick up that story, and then you're going to tell us the specifics of how Jimmy Hoffa was killed and what became of the body. Stay with us, everyone. Charles Brandt, author of I Heard You Paint Houses, is my guest. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Charles Brandt, author of I Heard You Paint Houses, about Frank the Irishman Sheeran and the evidence that strongly suggests he's the guy who killed Jimmy Hoffa. When we come back, we'll be looking at the how and why of that murder. Also, a little historical footnote. Our Coast to Coast colleague, George Norrie, I remember him telling me that he was a reporter back in those days and got what may be the last interview with Jimmy Hoffa while Hoffa was alive. I'd like to hear George maybe tell us more details about that interview at some point. When we come back, Charles Brandt picks up the story of how he got Frank Sheeran's confidence, and then the crime itself. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Brandt, let's finish the story of how you gained the confidence of Frank the Irishman Sheeran, and then we'll jump to the Hoffa crime.
You bet. So we get to Mona Lisa Restaurant in South Philly, and it turns out that what it is it's closed. It's a mob trial. Billy D'Elia, the underboss, was there representing Frank Sheeran. It was like a civil trial. Sheeran felt that when he contended that when he went to prison, there were two guys who were collecting loan shark money for him, and they claimed they gave the money to the prior Philly boss, a guy named Little Nicky Scarfo, and that they collected each week from the loan shark victim. And Scarfo sent word back from jail that they never gave him the money. So Sheeran, you know, had these two guys on trial. John Stanford, the then boss of the Philly family, was the judge. Stanford's underboss was their legal representation, the two torpedoes who Frank felt owed him money. And Frank was represented by Billy D'Elia. And I'm sitting at the bar,
Oh, my gosh.
Jimmy Lynch, the Catholic. The bar is open, it's free, and there's Italian food in at a table near the trial. The whole proceeding lasted 5 hours, including getting there and getting back to the apartment. And we get in the car afterwards, and Frank is elated. He'd been drinking his red wine, his Chianti, and he said, look at the respect they give me. They only do this for Italians. The two torpedoes were ordered to pay Frank $1,500 a week until he told them that they could stop. Yes, sir. And I'm in the back seat, and then Frank says to Jimmy Lynch, the Catholic, Franny's got problems, Jimmy. Got nothing to do with me, nothing to do with this, but Franny's got big problems. And I knew Franny. Franny was the guy that brought me the fee when Frank was in jail. And Franny was at our table, at the celebration when Frank got out of jail at Vincenti's restaurant. Franny had raised a toast to Frank. May the feds leave you alone. And I'm in the back seat, and I hear Franny's got problems. And Jimmy Lynch doesn't like it. Jimmy's going, Franny's good people, Frank. I hate to see anything happen to Franny. And Frank is saying, look, it's out of my hands. And they had this conversation the whole way back to the apartment. So 5 hours have elapsed, and Jimmy Lynch, the Catholic, true to his name, said, this whole thing about Franny has me upset. I'm going home, going to bed. And now I'm sitting there with Frank Sheeran. He's sitting on a lazy boy, and I've got him to myself. Practically his first words were, people don't think the FBI knows what the F they're doing. The FBI knows what the F they're doing. And he substantiated the Hoffax memo, which I confess I had never even heard of. I knew very little about the Hoffa matter. And other than that Frank Sheeran was a suspect, we all knew that in Delaware. A local paper reminded us of that. And so I had Frank Sheeran to myself. I had him to myself for my own 5 hours with him. And in the course of the conversation, he laid out what the people had done, who was involved, that sort of thing, and their roles. But he was very hesitant. He put himself there. He put himself at the house in Detroit as a member of the conspiracy to kill Jimmy Hoffa. And you have to remember, he's elated by having his legal victory. He's been drinking wine. And as I said earlier, he really needed to get something off his chest. You have to come up with a new word for the word remorse. He felt such remorse. And one of the techniques that you use is you keep a guy talking the way you've been keeping me talking, George. Keep a guy talking, and you hope that the truth finds a way out. But you don't want any lulls. You don't want that moment of reflection for him. And so it looked like a lull was coming. And so I asked him an innocent question, but I basically knew the answer to. And my question was, why were there so many people involved, Frank? Tony Pro, Tony Jack, the Andretta brothers, Sal Bergoglio, Chucky O'Brien, you, Russell. And Frank said, well, that way, if you go bad, meaning if you become a cooperating witness for the FBI, if you go bad, that way you only know what you did. You don't know what the ones before you did and the ones after you did. There's only so much you could tell. Well, I'd seen a movie as a young man, a very minor little, movie called Blast of Silence about a contract killer that's brought to New York from Cleveland to do a hit. It's a high-profile hit. And at the end of the movie, his reward is that he's killed. And so based on that movie, I said to Frank, I could also see where if you did a high-profile hit like this by yourself, you'd probably be killed yourself, this movie I'd seen. And Frank said, you'd have to be out of your mind to take a hit like this by yourself. There's not going to be a massacre, but a lone cowboy is going to be disposable. And I said, yeah, a lone cowboy like, say, Lee Harvey Oswald. And no sooner are the words out of my mouth than Frank starts to turn to stone.
Oh,
and
boy.
I realized I'm onto something. And I said, like Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone assassin, if it was Jack Ruby's job to get rid of him, and he gets stonier as I'm talking, and his right hand starts to move a little bit like he's waving me away. And I said, but I kept it up. You know, I knew I was onto something. The interrogator in me was like, holy Christ, what is this? And I said, and I said to him, and it's true, I said, I've never read a book on this, but it always seemed to me, I was teaching junior high at the time, it always seemed to me that it had to be Ruby's job to kill Oswald, and if he didn't do it out on the street, he better do it in the prison, in the jail. And all of a sudden, Sheeran waves me off with his right hand and says, I'm not going anywhere near Dallas. Oh, my God. I mean, you can imagine how surreal that was for me. I didn't want to go anywhere near Dallas. What are you talking about? It's enough for me to be wanting to go near the Hoffa hit. He gave me, by the time I left, I told my wife and my partner, he gave me about 80% of the Hoffa story. He knows something about Dallas. And they both cautioned me to be careful, but I knew enough to be careful. So I typed up a synopsis. I left the Dallas reference out completely, and I presented it to him. And I'm sitting there with him at his apartment while he's reading it, and he's turning to stone again. This was the third time he turned to stone. The first time was when I was telling him how we were going to get him out of jail when he was in prison. The second time was when he said, I'm not going anywhere near Dallas, out of the blue. And here he is turning to stone again, like he couldn't believe himself that he told me all this stuff that was in my synopsis, where I'm using the names, Steve Andretta, Tommy Andretta, you know. And it was like he was yelling at me, like I should know better, like I was stupid. You can't write about these people. These people are still alive. Well, Russell is still the boss, and Russell was about 90 then, but he was still the boss of the family. And he said, I'm taking this. And he took my synopsis, but, you know, of course I had plenty more, you know. It was on a computer. I had another copy of it. I still have a copy of it. And he said, these people are still alive. You can't write this. And I said, well, if they die or when they die and you change your mind, Frank, give me a call. And
Let's fast forward. There comes a time
later,
when
1999, yeah. He gave me the call that led to the 5 years of interviews that led to this book.
He was dying. He was dying, and he allowed you to videotape a lot of the details where he laid it out.
Yep.
In part, he allowed this because he wanted to save his soul, right?
Well, absolutely. He had a deathbed conversion back to his Catholic faith. And he said, if there is something more than this, and I got a shot at it, I don't want to close the door. He said that more than once. That was my wife's favorite quote of his when she was in his company.
So tell me the story, why Hoffa had to go, what the circumstances were that the mob decided he's got to go.
Well, Hoffa had a longstanding feud with the Attorney General of the United States, Bobby Kennedy. Kennedy had a Get Hoffa squad, and they got Hoffa. And Hoffa ended up doing 7 years in federal prison. He appointed a caretaker president for his Teamsters while he was away, Frank Fitzsimmons. And while Hoffa did business with the mob, he wasn't afraid of the mob. Fitzsimmons was scared to death of the mob. And the mob found that they could do business much more easily with Fitzsimmons than they could with Hoffa. When Hoffa got out of jail on a presidential pardon by Nixon, with money greasing the wheels of that, Fitzsimmons wouldn't step down, and Hoffa decided to pursue the presidency in the upcoming election. And the mafia was not happy with that. They warned him. Stay at home, play with your grandchildren. We're very happy to have Fitzsimmons in as president of the mafia. We don't want you in. And then Hoffa began making reckless public comments that he was going to expose how Fitzsimmons opened the treasury of the Teamsters Union to the mafia. Well, he was doing what Hoffa had done. He was just doing it on a larger scale. And that kind of irresponsible talk, Sheeran said, was just puffing. Hoffa was puffing. He was no rat. But the mafia had an expression that Frank taught me: when in doubt, have no doubt. And the mafia began to doubt that they could trust Hoffa, and it was time for him to go. And they knew that the only one that could get close enough to do it was Frank Sheeran, and so the order was given to Frank.
And you describe in the book this what must have been an amazing scene where Buffalino talks to his friend Frank Sheeran very candidly about what needed to be done, and that he was the guy.
Yeah, and Sheeran knew that he couldn't say no to Russell. Sheeran said, if I ever said no to Russell, you and I wouldn't be sitting here talking right now. Jimmy would have been just as dead, and I'd have gone to Australia with him.
Going to Australia.
One of the techniques I used in interrogation, you blame the victim. And one of the techniques I used was to say that, my God, Hoffa said that? Man, he was asking for it, Frank. You know, he was signing his own death warrant there, Frank. You know, you make a guy feel maybe that the victim had something to do with getting himself killed, which Hoffa did. He really did. And it loosened Frank's tongue a little more. In that meeting at Brutico's restaurant, Old Forge, Pennsylvania, where Russell explained that it was too late. Your friend has gone too far. And Sheeran knew he couldn't say no, and he didn't want to say anything that sounded negative. But he did say the fallout's going to hit the fan on this when the body's found. And Russell put his thumb on the table like he was grinding down on the table, and he said, dust to dust, there won't be a body. And that Sheeran interpreted that to mean that the body will be cremated. And after the hit, Buffalino told Sheeran that the body was cremated.
All right, let's talk about the hit itself. When you hear the music in about 4 minutes, that tells us we need to go to a break. But in the next 4 minutes, tell us how it went down.
Well, Hoffa wanted to square his beef with the mafia, and his biggest enemy in the mafia was Tony Provenzano, who was president of a huge local, Teamsters local in New Jersey. And Tony Giacalone of the Detroit outfit arranged a meeting for Hoffa to square his beef with Tony Pro. They were going to meet at a restaurant in the Marcus Red Fox restaurant just outside of Detroit. And Hoffa asked Sheeran to accompany him to that meeting. Hoffa goes. He's in the parking lot of the Marcus Red Fox restaurant, and nobody shows up. Sheeran was supposed to come a half hour earlier, and then Tony Jack and Tony Pro was supposed to come, and the four of them would have this meeting. And Hoffa called home, wanted to know if there were any messages for him at home, called his wife, and he's at a payphone, and he's walking from the payphone back to the Red Fox restaurant. The payphone was at a hardware store. And all of a sudden, along comes a car, a maroon Mercury. Chucky O'Brien is driving it. Chucky was Hoffa's foster son. Chucky was a dupe. Chucky had no idea what was going on. In the front seat was Frank Sheeran. In the back seat was this person, Sal Bergoglio, who Hoffa didn't even know. Sal Bergoglio was Tony Pro's man. And Hoffa demanded to know what the hell was going on. And Sal said, look who's here. And he points to Frank in the front seat. And Hoffa sees Frank is there and realizes that everything is okay. And they explain to him that Russell decided he wanted to be at the meeting. So the meeting is going to be held at a house. There's no way Russell would ever meet in a restaurant, a public restaurant. So Hoffa felt comfortable to get in the car. He gets in the car. In fact, that maroon Mercury, a hair of Hoffa's, was found in the back seat of that car. DNA later, years later, proved after Sheeran had confessed to me, DNA came out to corroborate it. And they drove to the house, a house that Sheeran and I later found, and I took photographs of it. There's a photograph of it in the book. Hoffa got out. Hoffa always went first. Wherever he was going, he got out in front of you. And Sheeran coming up behind him. Sal Bergoglio wasn't going to be at a meeting like that. It wasn't big enough. And Chuckie O'Brien then drove away and drove Sal to wherever Sal was going to rendezvous. Sal, both Sal and the Andretta brothers were from Tony Pro's local in New Jersey. And inside the house, in the kitchen, were the two Andretta brothers. They were the cleaners. Their job was to dispose of the body. And so Hoffa walks in. Sheeran walks in behind him in the vestibule. And Hoffa right away can see that there's nobody there. And he heads for the door. And as he brushes past Sheeran to get to the door, Sheeran puts two in the back of his head. Hoffa hits the ground. Sheeran goes out, gets in his car, drives to the airport that he had come in on, and there was a private jet plane waiting for him. Medico Industries was a munitions manufacturer, the largest seller of munitions to the American government and to the Army was Medico, controlled by Bufalino, and he controlled their pilot and their jet planes. And that's how Sheeran made his getaway in a jet plane, plane. Anyway,
the two brothers?
The two Andretta brothers disposed of the body. Sheeran was told that it was done with the help of a funeral parlor in Detroit that was controlled by the outfit. And that would be Bagnasco's. Bob Garrity, the Hoffa case agent, told me that they checked out Bagnasco's, but there's only so much checking out you can do. There's no scientific way of determining whose ashes were incinerated. And so Hoffa was cremated, according to Russell telling Frank. Frank doesn't know. The only one who really knows, Steve Andretta died of cancer, but Tommy Andretta is alive and well, living in Las Vegas. When the book first came out in 2004, Ed Barnes, a Fox News producer and a former organized crime investigator for the state of New York, stalked Andretta, found out where he lived, waited for him. When Andretta got home, Barnes got out of his car, walked up, holding my hardback book then, 2004.
Hold on, Charles. Charles, sorry to interrupt. That's a bad place to stop, but we'll pick that story up on the other side because I, too, have tried to talk to that same witness, and we'll hear that part of it as soon as we come back. Much more to come here. I heard you paint houses is the book. Coast to Coast continues.
Upstate New York, November 1957.
One more time, Mo. Don't forget, for those of you who are trying to do your estate, now, inside the archives, you have your estate manual, you have your estate letter, and you have all the other supporting documents. And for those of you who want to get out there and place that thing in the hands of your employee to stop it from taking taxes out your check, go right to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Once you get there, look around. If you click on the letters under the picture, a little drop-down menu come back and give you a little additional information on that. But before you do anything, call me, Tucker Amana L. Bay, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
We've just heard Charles Brandt, author of I Heard You Paint Houses, explain the last moments of Jimmy Hoffa's life, how he was killed, and when we come back, we continue the story of what became of the body, the last remaining eyewitness, a guy who's still alive here in Las Vegas, and then we're going to get into the JFK story before we open up the phone lines with your questions. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Brandt, please continue the story of the attempts to contact the what effectively is the last remaining witness.
All right. So Ed Barnes, the stalker, sees Tommy Andretta and goes up to him, tries to give him my book. Andretta doesn't even look at him, just focuses on his front door, gives him the cold shoulder, walks in and shuts the door in Ed's face while Ed is still trying to ask him questions. At that moment, the garage door rolls up. And Mrs. Andretta is standing there with her hand out. Ed puts the book in her hand and starts to ask her questions, and the garage door rolls back down. And that's the last sighting that I know of, anybody actually making an attempt to interview Tommy Andretta. But it's It's a country now where they don't have to answer questions. When I was a kid, you know, you'd routinely get picked up for questioning, but that doesn't happen anymore.
Well, you came to town and we did an interview.
All these dead wives out there, these cats that kill their wives and go about their business and never answer a single question.
After you came to town and we did the interview some years ago, I also tried to get a hold of Tommy Andretta. We went by the house. We called it. I even sent a letter to see if he'd decide to open up. Of course, that didn't happen. I don't even know if he's still alive now. But
he is. Yeah, he definitely is. I'm kind of connected now to stuff, you know.
Why does this story ring true? And tell me about the reaction from federal lawmen who knew the case well since the book came out.
Well, I can tell you that the FBI knows, and they have since you and I talked, they have subpoenaed my tapes, and anyway, they can't comment because the case is still active. As long as Tommy Andretta's alive, Chucky O'Brien's alive, they're the last two remaining suspects that are living.
But you've had feedback from people like Stan Hunterton here in Las Vegas and other lawmen.
Oh, Stan, absolutely. You had him on the segments. Stan was an assistant U.S. attorney who prepared the search warrant that got the hair from the Mercury, Hoffa's hair in that maroon Mercury. And, yes, Stan has endorsed it. A number of people have publicly endorsed Frank Sheeran. I like to just say, you know, just look at the Gallo case. Just examine that. If you read nothing else, examine that. And you know that Frank Sheeran's telling the truth.
All these other stories that come out, Hoffa's buried in Giant Stadium, or even this one last week where the FBI is out digging up a hole, digging holes in this field in, near Detroit. Why are they still looking at places like that? How do these stories pop up? Is it just a matter of some mob source trying to gain some influence with the FBI or some attention, or what is it?
Well, in this last one, Zerilli, the son of a boss, the boss of the Detroit outfit, and Zerilli was himself underboss of the outfit, and he had a website, and on his website he was selling autographed photographs of himself for $7.99 a pop, and he was selling a book he wrote about Hoffa's disappearance you could download for $4.99 a pop. And why did the FBI fall for it? Well, it isn't a matter of falling for it. When a person with the last name Zerilli from Detroit tells you something, you have to pay attention. And Frank would be the first one to tell you that he did not know of his own knowledge what happened to Hoffa. He only knows he was told that Hoffa was cremated. And the guy who knows is Tommy Andretta. So the FBI is faced with, and it was an easy dig. It was supposedly a shallow grave that Zerilli claimed he was buried in. So it's just a kind of bulldozing kind of dig. It was not a long, drawn-out affair.
But I thought
it's a shame that Sheeran didn't actually participate in the disposal of the body, but that would never have been his job. He didn't do that. That was a lesser job in the ranking of jobs.
One of the stories that we sort of brushed over, you mentioned about Hoffa being able to get out of prison in part because of money that was paid to the Attorney General of the country, John Mitchell, and to presumably to Nixon or somebody in the administration that was instrumental in him getting out. And who delivered that money and how much was it?
Well, Frank delivered two sums. One was $500,000. He drove down from Philly with a suitcase with $500,000 in it. Met Mitchell at I think it was a Hyatt or a Hilton, I forget now, in the lobby. They had pleasant conversation, and then when Mitchell got up, he picked up the suitcase, and Sheeran said to him, "Aren't you going to count it?" And Mitchell said, "If I had to count it, they wouldn't have sent you." And that was the first sum that was brought, and that was to get the pardon. When the pardon was given, it had restrictions on Hoffa's union activities, and Hoffa wanted those restrictions removed, and so Sheeran brought another $270,000 down, and he brought this directly to Mitchell's house in Washington. Sheeran handed Mitchell the satchel of money, and Mitchell handed Sheeran an affidavit that said that the pardon did not have or should not have had restrictions on it. And that affidavit is one of the photos in the book. And an interesting story. My publisher, Chip Fleischer, Steerforth Press, he loved the book and he wanted to publish it. And he but he's a young man and he couldn't get over the idea that an attorney general of the United States was a bag man for the president. And he mentioned it to his parents. His father's a prominent attorney in Kansas. And his father told him that years earlier, Senator Dole of Kansas told the president of the Cattlemen's Association or something, Meatpacking Association, I don't know, in Kansas, that he was concerned about Nixon and Mitchell, that they must be plotting a coup because they just keep getting their hands on as much cash as they can. And I'll tell you another story about Bob Mayhew. I guess you knew him, and I'm sure you interviewed him many times. But I got from a very reliable source that Mayhew brought cash on behalf of Howard Hughes to the Hotel Pierre in Manhattan, where Nixon and Mitchell had a suite of offices. And on more than one occasion, Mayhew brought cash on Howard Hughes' behalf. And cash contributions, unlimited, were legal then. It's what they did with them that was illegal. I mean, they used them for their own purposes. They didn't use them for the campaign. But Nixon created the laws essentially because of his wrongdoing. He created the laws that we now have of campaign finance.
Well, I interviewed Peter Mayhew, the son of Bob Mayhew, less than 2 weeks ago. He basically told me that not only his father, but that he had also delivered money. And it was legal back in those days that Hughes wanted influence with the Nixon administration and sent him a bunch of cash. Let's talk about the movie. Now, I can just see the scene of that garage door going down with the lady holding the copy of your book. But there is a movie in the works, and the lineup of people involved in it is astounding.
It's astounding. I got an email in 2007 from a gal at Tribeca Films, Robert De Niro's company, wanting to know if the rights were available. You know, I'd crawl on my knees to bring them to her, you know. And it ended up that Robert De Niro and Martin Scorsese bought the rights and then struck a deal with Paramount to produce the movie. And Red Granite Productions, Irwin Winkler, the famous producer, is involved. Jane Rosenthal for Tribeca. These are all major heavyweights on the producing end of it. Scorsese is going to direct it. De Niro's going to play the role of Sheeran above the age of, say, 50-ish. They've got a younger actor, and I don't know who that is, going to play the younger Frank Sheeran, who goes off to war. As I've mentioned, it's a biography, a full story of a man's life, fascinating life. So they're covering the whole story. The screenwriter is Steve Zalian, who is the hottest screenwriter in Hollywood. He won the Oscar for adapting Schindler's List. He just did Moneyball. He did American Gangster, on and on. And
the cast.
Al Pacino is going to play Hoffa. Joe Pesci is going to play Russell Bufalino. And then a number of fairly prominent character actors like Paul Herman, Frank Grillo, Bobby Cannavale. And then they've got a female character, or so. I haven't actually seen the screenplay, but they had a table reading in Manhattan, where at Tribeca Films, where they sit around the table and read the script. And the article in the New York Post about it said that at at certain points, it was so funny that all of the reading stopped while everybody laughed hysterically. And a guy who, I can't give you a name, but a guy who was present and participated in the reading told me the script is on the order of The Godfather. It's going to be a long movie. It's going to be 2.5 to 3 hours. And it requires a lot of pre-production work, and they continue to work on it. So, you know, inch by inch, we get closer to having a movie made.
Nice that it's at Paramount, which was, of course, the studio that gave us The Godfather, and we've talked about the connections there. Let's take a couple of minutes and talk about JFK. I would imagine that was tough to get Sheeran, even on his deathbed, to talk about. But what did he tell you about the link between the mob and the murder of JFK?
Well, I have to say I was somewhat disappointed by what he did tell me, because I was hoping he knew more than he knew. But he knew that the mob was involved in the JFK hit, and he knew it through every fiber of his body. Before, some weeks before the hit, he got a call from Jimmy Hoffa to go see your friend. And it was always, Hoffa would call, Sheeran would go to a payphone and then return the call. And all that Hoffa said was, go see your friend. Sheeran drove up couple of hours, actually 4 hours, from his office in Wilmington to upstate Pennsylvania. When he got there, all that Russell said to him, didn't even let him in the house. It was very strange to Sheeran. Russell greeted him at the door and said, go see our friends in Brooklyn. He got in his car and he drove to Monty's Italian restaurant in South Brooklyn, Italian area. Then Monty's is the oldest Italian restaurant in the city of New York. When he got there, Tony Provenzano gave him a duffel bag full of rifles, three high-powered rifles, with instructions to take it to a place they'd used in the past, a cement company, Campbell Cement Company, outside of Baltimore. And it had a its own private runway for planes. And Sheeran brought the guns to the airport, and at the airport was a plane with the pilot, Dave Ferry, who in the ridiculous movie JFK, if you'll excuse me for starting a controversy here, but in the movie JFK, the David Ferry character is played by Joe Pesci. He's a real-life character who was a pilot for Carlos Marcello, the boss of the New Orleans family. New Orleans, the town that Lee Harvey Oswald was from, where Lee Harvey Oswald's uncle was a bookmaker. And Sheeran delivered the rifles, never thought a thing about it. After the killing of JFK, Sheeran wondered, did the rifles have something to do with it? Fast forward to 1974, Frank Sheeran Appreciation Night at the Latin Casino nightclub outside of Philly in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. 3,000 guests. Mayor Frank Rizzo, the head of the NAACP for Philly, was there. Everybody was there to toast Frank Sheeran. Frank Sheeran Appreciation Night. All the mobsters were there. And the night before, there was a private meeting between Hoffa, Russell Bufalino, Angelo Bruno, and Frank Sheeran at Broadway Eddie's, a local bar near the in the heart of the mafia district of Philadelphia. And at that meeting, for the first time ever, Russell warned Hoffa not to run, and that he should stay home with his grandchildren. And Hoffa said, "I'm running. I'm going to get everybody that effed me." And at the table, Russell said to Hoffa, and sitting right next to Hoffa was Frank Sheeran, and he said very softly, "There are people that don't think you're showing appreciation for Dallas." And It was time for Hoffa to leave. He was staying at the Warwick Hotel, and Frank was going to drive him to the Warwick. And as he's leaving, Russell says to Frank, tell your friend what it is, which means tell your friend he's going to be killed if he doesn't back off. What it is another expression that the book reveals. Sheeran gets to the hotel and tells Hoffa, Russell himself told me to tell you what it is. And Hoffa said, they wouldn't dare. Now, Hoffa was very volatile, very wild man, kind of the Louis Prima of mafia bosses, you know. And he got all wound up, and he said to Frank that those rifles that you remember, those rifles you took, you picked up and you delivered to Dave Ferry, they were for use in Dallas. I know so many things, and they're all going to come out if anything unnatural happens to me.
Wow.
And
there's one other fact you mentioned.
I mean, all that Hoffa did, he knew Frank had to report back to Russell whatever Hoffa said. And all that Hoffa did was dig himself deeper. So there you have it. You know, Frank knew because both Russell and Hoffa told him. And I, in fact, in that tell him what it is, when Frank got back and reported to Russell that Hoffa said, you know, they wouldn't dare, Russell repeated it. Russell said, if we can take out the president, we could take out the president of Teamsters. So, and that, you know, that's what scared Frank. That's why he wasn't going anywhere near Dallas. It took all of my skills at cross-examination when we got back together in 1999, 8 years after the initial conference with him, when we got back together for our regular meetings where we would go to the mafia social clubs and hang out together. It took all my skills to get him to tell me all that he knew about JFK. And since then, I still haven't read a book, but I do quote in my book a quote from Frank Regano, who was a mafia lawyer for both Hoffa and Carlos Marcello in New Orleans, and also Santo Trafficante in Florida, in Tampa, Florida. He was having a meeting with Hoffa. And Hoffa said to Regano that when he reports back to Carlos and Santo to tell them that it's time now to kill Kennedy.
Wow. One other fact I want to bring up when we come back is about Jack Ruby and his connection. He was much more than just a nightclub owner for the mob. The Shantae's taking us into the break with Pipeline, and we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions from my guest, Charles Brandt, author of I Heard You Paint Houses. Stay with us, everyone. We're talking with Charles.
Okay, Moz, we come to the end of the broadcast. Very, very interesting story. And I'm glad that we was able to shed some light on some stuff here in regards to the mafia inside the United States. We will be back with some more information in regards to your mortgages and contract law and all that stuff. But we're going to have to leave the air, and appreciate you all being here. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and until next time, you all y'all have a good night.
Come on, make my dream come true. Love can be so unkind. You are truly blessed when it's true love you find. So woman, don't be afraid to lose control. We must trust our touch. If we give of ourselves, can share so much. Love and affection no longer a dream. Come on, release yourself and you see what I mean. So woman, don't be afraid. woman, don't be afraid. Will never rain in your face. Oh, I'm bringing joy to take that place. Let them say that I'm weak for you, but what we have tonight will make us stronger as two. So woman, don't be afraid. Woman, don't be afraid.
Can be so unkind. Oh, you truly blessed.